Hello, everyone, and welcome to this edition of Next Witness, Please. We're a podcast that translates legal jargon into understandable everyday terms for just regular folks. Our goal is to build understanding about the law and our legal systems. I'm retired Judge Tom Hodson, and I'm joined, as always, by my co-host, retired Judge Gail Williams Byers. Hi, Gail.
Hey, Judge Tom. Good to hear from you.
You ready to roll?
Rock and roll. Yes, all I right. am. And we've got some cool stuff to talk about.
We do. Today, we're going to dig a bit deeper into the motions filed by Donald Trump's attorneys in the New York hush money case, or the business records case, officially. After the Supreme Court made its decision on presidential immunity back on July 1st, Trump's attorneys moved to vacate the 34 felony guilty verdicts against Trump, saying that improper evidence was allowed to be introduced at the trial, thereby tainting the verdicts. And so the verdicts should be wiped out. And they even went so far as saying not just should the verdicts be wiped out, but the whole indictments back to the initial charging documents, back to the grand jury, all of it should be wiped out and dismissed. Well, just recently, July 24th, the district attorney, Alvin Bragg, his office filed their reply, and it really sets up some really interesting questions. We should note that Judge Juan Merchan is the judge in this matter. He has said that he will render a decision by September 6th. And he also has said that the sentencing for Donald Trump currently is scheduled for September 18th. So that's sort of the situation we're in. I want to start off with the motion from Trump's attorneys, Judge Gale. They filed a 55-page motion, really jumping in and claiming that the immunity case prohibited certain evidence to be used. So let me just give you a quick summary of the immunity case, and then I want Judge Gale to check me and make sure I'm right. The Trump versus United States immunity case, the Supreme Court case on July 1st, that decision said that for all official acts of the President of the United States, that there was absolute immunity. And that means official acts that were based in the Constitution, absolute immunity. On other official acts not based on constitutional actions, there was a presumption of immunity. In other words, somebody who wanted to bring a criminal action had to get over that presumption. The other thing that the court said, that there are unofficial acts of the president, but those unofficial acts have to be proven again by the prosecution, and that you can't use evidence from official acts to prove unofficial acts. Now, that gets really complicated, and I know that's confusing. But the court said you can't use official acts to prove unofficial acts. And that's really what the motion filed by Trump's attorneys is all about, isn't it?
Absolutely. And, you know, another thing is, I think we saw this coming.
Yeah, we
did. Especially after the Supreme Court ruled the way that it did, it all but rolled out the red carpet for this type of response to the existing return of the verdicts.
But the difference is that we've talked about Judge Chutkan in the Washington case, the election overturning case, the January 6th case, however you want to call it. We talked about Judge Cannon in Florida on the documents case. She's already thrown that out based upon the immunity decision. We talked about the Georgia case. All of those are pre-trial cases. This is the only case that the trial's already happened.
Right? And so it kind of, and speaking of checking, I want you to check me on this because I was thinking about this just the other day when I thought about this motion practice, this kind of post-verdict motion practice. In my mind, I don't know that there's an awful lot of daylight, although, again, there are some small legal nuances, but I don't know there's an awful lot of daylight between this, what's happening here, and what the defense requested after the jury rendered its verdict when they requested for a judgment notwithstanding the verdict. Obviously, the basis and the reason is different because they didn't have the ruling from the Supreme Court. But functionally, this is, at least in my mind, it just feels like a delayed motion for a JNOV. Would you agree?
Judgment notwithstanding the verdict, JNOV is our yes. shorthand version, and we need to translate that.
Yes.
It's a variation of that, and you know, I have to tell you that I have, in all of my judicial experience, never come across an animal like this, which is a motion to vacate the verdicts. Motion to vacate, a motion notwithstanding the verdict is basically, judge, this jury is a runaway train, and they made decisions that no evidence could support. You need to jump in and take over and right this ship, and you need to make the decision in our favor. Here they're saying, judge, assume you did everything right, and assume the jury did everything right, and assume that the guilty verdict came down. The trial was messed up because after the fact, the Supreme Court made a decision that applied to you back in June. They made the decision in July. This should apply to you back in June, and you should have applied it, but you didn't because you didn't know about it. Does that make sense?
Does it have to?
No, but that seems to be a basis for the motion to vacate.
Indeed, I would agree. Is, you know, this is exactly kind of the foretelling that that no doubt the judge was expected to have, and that the defense kind of imputes to them. I mean, just as unreasonable, but it's when you are a defense attorney. And whether your client is high profile or just someone that, you know, just happens to be able to afford your services, whatever that may be, you're going to fight as hard as you possibly can. And sometimes, yes, your arguments will seem fairly, you know, nuanced and unique. They may seem like you cause a little whiplash. But the fact of the matter is that every good defense attorney is going to try to exhaust every avenue available to them to defend and respond to what they think is the aggressive advocacy necessary for their client. And this is kind of it, even if, again, it causes a little bit of whiplash.
Yeah, and I, you know, I was a defense attorney for a number of decades, and I would do the same thing. I don't fault them for filing it. I just think it's a creative approach. You talked about a judgment notwithstanding the verdict, and that's recognized in the law. It's in the rules of procedure, both in federal courts and state courts. It's a recognized practice. There's also something that we haven't talked about, which is a motion for new trial. That comes up often, and I would file those as a defense attorney, saying that, oh, there's new evidence that we just now discovered that is critical to the guilt or innocence of somebody, a witness that just now came forward, or the prosecution hid evidence from us, and we're just now finding that out. So, Judge, we need a new trial.
Mm-hmm.
That's also recognized in procedure and law.
And also not terribly uncommon, right?
And not uncommon. I would do that if I had any glimmer, especially on serious cases. Somebody gets 25 to life or whatever. You are always looking for something like that.
And oftentimes it takes fresh eyes. It's not, in my experience, it wouldn't be uncommon necessarily for there to be a different or new attorney.
A different attorney. I would do that and look over and say they had a public defender at trial. The public defender would reach out to me and say, look, you know, you throw me under the bus here if you have to for my client. But, you know,
turn me into Justice Alito's wife. Put a tire track on my back.
But take a look at this and file something to get somebody. And that's why people, you know, our listeners, if you see cases occasionally where somebody's been in prison for 20, 30 years or whatever, and then they find out they've been wrongfully convicted. There's a whole innocence project that goes on in various parts of the country to do just that. Well, that's asking for a new trial based on evidence. This is saying, no, eliminate the verdict and eliminate the indictment based on a Supreme Court ruling that has to do with evidence. It's a strange animal.
Indeed. Indeed. But I will also say I tie this right back to the Supreme Court, who actually created this animal. It was, you know, cooked up in a lab, because I think both of us agree that it requires severe stretching of the imagination to understand how the decision itself was stitched together. And notwithstanding that, the fallout or the ramifications and the reliance upon that has sweeping effects and impacts. This is exactly what we should have expected when we got this, you know, this new animal from the U.S. Supreme Court that will no doubt call into question. And here's what's interesting is, so it certainly affects and impacts the uniqueness of this situation, because in my lifetime, and obviously even Richard Nixon avoided indictment and prosecution, but in my lifetime, I've never seen a U.S. president face the formality of the criminal justice system, and then to rely so heavily on a safety net from a majority Supreme Court that he was able to actually orchestrate. This is something very, very new.
We've talked in previous broadcasts about the fact that Judge Chutkan and other judges will have evidentiary hearings to determine whether something is an official act or a non-official act, and whether something is allowable into evidence and not allowable. And we've actually said those hearings may take weeks. This is going to be decided apparently just on the paper arguments, and Judge Mershon's going to get the first crack at some of this. What impact is that going to have on later decisions, perhaps?
So that kind of remains to be seen. But what I want to kind of crystallize a little bit for our listeners is something that you just said, which is the fact that there are these motions or requests to the court, specifically to Judge Mershon, to either do something or don't do something. The defense has made it clear what they would like for the judge to do: throw out everything, take it all the way back to the grand jury and essentially take a legal eraser to all of this and erase all of this as if it had never happened, because the ruling from the Supreme Court and our interpretation says that it never should have happened. Conversely, the prosecution and DA Bragg's office has responded and held steadfast to the fact that this was an appropriate investigation. This was an appropriate process. This was an appropriate presentation to the grand jury, as it was an appropriate presentation to the court and the jury. The finding is binding, and we're asking the court to deny the defense's motion and please move forward with sentencing the defendant. What you just said is that Judge Marchand is going to make a determination or decision based on the papers, meaning that the motion that the defense submitted to the court, which Judge Marchand will read through it, I am confident thoroughly, and he will appreciate the arguments as made, and he will do the same for the prosecution. But neither side, neither the attorneys for the former president nor the prosecutors representing DA Bragg's office will have an opportunity to physically come into the courtroom and to further argue or buttress or add to their paper motions, meaning the filings they've presented to the court.
Unless Judge Marchand wants them to.
Exactly. Unless he schedules what's called an oral hearing, he will not likely hear any further arguments. And so that's why it's so important that if you are placing something before the court, you never know if you'll have an opportunity to actually walk in and to physically articulate your position and add maybe a little bit more information that you've recently learned. Instead, you have sometimes just that one opportunity to lay everything out in a very careful manner for the judge so that they can understand what your position is, because oftentimes decisions are made based on just that. And so for those that are listening, that's exactly what Judge Tom was describing. He was describing the fact that so far, these attorneys have submitted their arguments in writing, and what's on the paper is what's going to be considered. Unless he decides that he's going to bring the parties in and have an actual argument and debate between each side on what their positions are and make a decision after that. But right now he retains the full authority to make a decision on this case without them ever even walking in the doors.
And Judge Gale, this is unique in another way. We've talked about Judge Chutkan and other judges having evidentiary hearings where people come in to rebut a presumption of an official act or to outline why something is an unofficial act. Here, there is no further testimony. It will not, even if he would call them in to have some kind of oral argument, there would not be any submission of evidence because the evidence is already there.
Yeah, it's already submitted. There will be no new witnesses. No one's going to take the stand.
The bow's already tied on this package.
I like that. The row's already tied. Yeah. Nobody's taking the stand, raising their right hand, promising to tell the truth. That ship has sailed. At most, it would be the attorneys making additional arguments about the positions that they've already outlined in their motions. But you're absolutely right. It differs from an evidentiary hearing where there is actual evidence in the form of testimony and sometimes even physical evidence. So you may have something demonstrable or something that demonstrates it, or you may have actual pieces of evidence that is presented before the court to help the court understand the evidentiary value of something and then make a decision. In fact, I think Judge Chutkan probably has the heaviest lift of all because the U.S. Supreme Court articulated a test that has no components. And so she has to actually fashion an actual test because they gave her no guidance. Judge Marchand is different because although U.S. Supreme Court cases certainly are a precedent, I mean, and I guess I could use air quotations when I say that because apparently the Supreme Court uses air quotations when they refer to precedent. So I don't know that precedent is the static thing that it once was. And the feeling of being compelled to follow it is waning, and not because there is you know, overall community resistance to precedent, but because that is being guided and started by the justices themselves. So if they aren't following precedent, then, you know, what is the motivation for other courts to lean so heavily into it? But that's another episode. That said, Judge Marchand is just, I think he's really going to make a thoughtful decision, but I don't know that it's necessarily going to impact anyone else in any other jurisdiction, any place else, even in New York, because there's really no such thing as precedent anymore.
I think, well, that's sort of a cynical approach now.
It is.
But there's some truth to it. I think that Judge Marchand is in a particularly bad spot because he is a student of law. He's going to follow the law. He's got some unique you may hear in the law the cases of first instance. Well, these are arguments of first instance. There's never been anything like this before because we've not had the presidential immunity case before or the terms of that case before. So he's in a unique bad spot.
He gets a new animal, Judge Tom. It's like the cross between a rooster and a pig.
There you go. I want to go through the defense arguments and then the prosecution's arguments and then come up with maybe some of the things that the judge has to decide. So that our listeners can follow through as they're listening and reading things over the next few weeks. The defense said that the prosecution relied on evidence at trial related to Trump's official acts as president in 2017 and 2018, and that the prosecution relied on what they called core executive acts where absolute immunity applied. And they talked specifically about the testimony of White House officials Hope Hicks and Madeleine Westerhout. Then they went on to say that the prosecution inappropriately relied on tweets that President Trump issued when he was president, and that those tweets should be prohibited from evidence because the Twitter account was, this is a quote, one of the White House's main vehicles for conducting official business. Woe is us.
Does that sound familiar to what I was saying, perhaps, at another time?
Yeah, it does. So, but they're saying testimony of Trump's work habits, preferences, relationships, and contacts, along with social media practices while he was president, was introduced into evidence to bolster his unofficial acts. And that's impermissible, and therefore the whole case should disappear. That's really what they're arguing in 55 pages.
So that's interesting because I suppose the response can be, even if we disregarded the testimony of those two witnesses or those witnesses, it comes back to the idea of can the core or essential elements of the charges be proven, notwithstanding the testimony of those witnesses and even, you know, the introduction of some of that evidence. I suspect the prosecution will wholeheartedly say, absolutely, there's a reason why you use the term bolster, because it does not mean that it was required. It was supplemental to, and also, you know, maybe even, you know, helpful, but it was not critical, necessary, or important. It merely provided context for the jurors. So,
but the but the defense already anticipated that, Judge, and they're saying, remember, prosecution, you said in closing argument that the testimony of Hope Hicks was devastating to the president. Well, if it was devastating, then it was important and it was inappropriate, and therefore the case should be dismissed.
And I think I disagree, because I don't know that the term devastating also means important. The term devastating could mean hurtful. It could mean contextualizing. Devastating, again, can be bolstering, but it does not make it by itself critical.
Okay.
That would be my response to the defense, is I stand by. Yes, I would stand by the term devastating, but I would argue that devastating in and of itself does not make something critical, necessary, or required. It makes it what it is: harmful. It makes it maybe even hurtful. It makes it disappointing, but it doesn't make it critical.
Let's move on to the defense, and then I want to tie this back together. We haven't left the prosecution, but I want to move on to the defense. In attorney, District Attorney Bragg's office's response, they said that even if all of this evidence that the defense has said shouldn't have been allowed, even if it's not allowed, this was the term they used, it's only a sliver, I love that word, sliver of the evidence against Trump, and therefore the verdict should not be set aside. What's your thought about that? You know, can you say as a judge, well, you know, you might be right, this evidence shouldn't have come in, but you know, even without it, your guy's still guilty.
Judge, perhaps I just harken back to those days of being a former prosecutor. I think this goes back to my earlier point, which is, you know, on balance, if you were to remove that evidence that the defense is talking about, you still have such overwhelming, you have the presentation of overwhelming evidence that nonetheless exists. So I would say to listeners, think of it like this. If you have a full cake, a bundt cake, and someone comes in and says, oh, that's a really nice cake that you made there. And let's say somebody else comes in and they cut about, you know, two or three slices. Maybe they take even a third of it. Does that make it any less of a cake? Does it make it any less of a recognizable cake? Do you not still understand by merely looking at it and appreciating it, what it looked like and what it was before those two or three pieces were removed? And that's, in my view, and maybe because it's, you know, I'm just a really good friend with food. I use food analogies. but when I think of this, I think that of the prosecution saying, this case is our cake. If you removed the things that the defense is now taking issue with, that those are slices from the cake. And so even although we don't necessarily agree that those slices should be removed, even if we did, and even if we provided that those slices could or should, or if in the court's wisdom it is removed, it's still a cake. Because guess what? The overwhelming part of the cake is still here. You can see what it is. You can make out what it is. There is no head scratching. You are not wondering if it was a sandwich. You never looked at it and thought it was a salad. You know it is a cake because look at it and you can fully recognize it for what it is. And that's what the prosecution's arguing, is that the main core of the case is untouched and unchanged. And therefore, the verdict should remain untouched and unchanged, because even if the court bought the defense's argument, it does not change the overwhelming evidence they believe they presented to bring about the juror's verdict.
Interestingly enough, the prosecution also said that the tweets, remember I told you the tweets in the defense motion, they said they were official acts.
These are the same ones that'll announce, you know, alliances with foreign countries. Just read
Twitter. main vehicles for conducting official business was the exact line. The prosecution said, hey, those tweets are already in the public record, and therefore they should be allowed because even the Supreme Court said things that are in the public record are allowable. It's the things behind the scenes that mm-hmm. may not be allowable. So they're making that argument as well.
It's not a private Twitter account, right? It's intended to, to catalog and to amplify and to announce. Yes, even if they are official policy positions, you're doing it on a public platform with the purpose that it will be seen publicly. It's the underlying public record. So you're not really hiding it. It's not like it's an internal memo. An internal White House memo that may survive some protections. It's not that. This is, you know, a 3 a.m., you know, tweet about, you know, feelings about a certain somebody from days gone by.
The prosecution made another argument here. I really like your take on because I find it a bit perplexing. The prosecutors argue that all of these things were unofficial acts of the president, and therefore all of the information should be allowed. But then they cite a federal judge in not moving the case from state court to federal court had already decided that the case had nothing to do with the presidency. If it had, it would have been moved to federal court. So therefore, that buttresses the argument that these are unofficial acts and not part of the presidency. What do you think of that argument?
Well, I think that for purposes of emotion practice and responding and giving Judge Mershon
throwing the kitchen sink in.
Yeah, just it's spaghetti at the wall. Is it al dente?
Right.
And because what will happen in motion practice when you have attorneys filing motions, you will often hear what appears, and whether it's the prosecution or defense or plaintiffs or defense, you will often hear what appears and sounds like it is conflicting arguments because they want the court to, they don't know exactly what the court is thinking and what line of reasoning the court is going to follow. You hope they follow yours and that your argument is persuasive, but you want to provide the court with options. That's why you have the, even if that was the case, or even if you buy that, then this is still the flaw. And I think this is very similar on both sides. I think you will find this in the defense motions as well as the prosecution, is that they're constantly providing the court with alternative ways to think about the evidence and the information so that they can still, that the court will still rule in their favor. And so, and again, these arguments don't have to be linear. They don't have to be complementary, meaning you don't have to pick one theory and only follow with that one theory. It is entirely possible to throw several theories or provide several theories to the court and essentially rely on the judge to take any one of them. Judge Tom, how many times have we read opinions and we say, my gosh, they found the tiniest one sentence in a brief somewhere and created an out of whole cloth, a whole opinion one buried sentence somewhere when everything else seemed compelling. And yet this one sentence stands out and the whole opinion is now centered around this. That I think happens very regularly. And whether it's in state court, federal court, or even at the Supreme Court level, I think it happens with a high level of frequency.
Three other things I want to talk about in relationship to this. And one, I think we have an opportunity to educate our listeners. One of the arguments the prosecution made is that the defense, during the course of the trial, did not raise these immunity questions as objections. And therefore, they waived or gave up their ability to complain about them after the fact. Now, that's true. Normally, we can follow that. This is a little different because we had a Supreme Court ruling come out after the fact.
Yes,
so but Judge Mershon's going to have to decide whether or not the defense should have objected to preserve it, knowing that the Supreme Court was looking at this, or whether or not they can now go back after the fact. You know, what about that whole idea of timely objection and waiver?
Well, that's exactly what I was saying as you were mentioning this, because you are right in that the U.S. Supreme Court issued its opinion and its ruling after the jury rendered its verdict. It did that. But the defense knew for the entirety of the trial that this matter was pending before the U.S. Supreme Court. It knew the arguments that it made, core or supplemental, and it knew the outcome it hoped to achieve. And so for that reason, yes, the defense would have a hard time explaining why they did not preserve this objection as a through line, if you will, to the state trial, knowing that they were hoping for this positive outcome from the U.S. Supreme Court, which actually could have helped to further, I think, underpin the defense's argument of, hey, judge, you knew and we knew that we had this issue before the U.S. Supreme Court and that they would make a determination about immunity. And because this has been, you know, essentially the theory of our case, and we don't believe that it's appropriate to even go forward with this trial, even if you make the objection at the beginning of the trial and say, judge, just note my continuing objection to this trial, all it takes is just that notice to the court so that it is so noted and for you to proceed on. But there is absolutely this idea that an objection that is not raised, meaning if you do not bring it up during the trial itself, then it means that you are essentially abandoning that as an objectable offense. You waive it. It's like waving goodbye to
it. And in a lot of cases, there are things that are, quote, objectionable that both sides let slide because it's not that important to the case, and you don't want to be interruptive or look too combative to a jury, whatever your reasons, you let something slide. But something that's major, you preserve for the record, it's a term that's used, that objection. So when Hope Hicks or Madeline Westerhout came forward, the defense should have said, Your Honor, we object to their testimony based upon presidential immunity that's currently pending before the U.S. Supreme Court. That would have preserved that objection, correct?
Absolutely. It would have placed the court on notice. It would have placed the prosecution on notice that this may in fact be an area or issue of appeal. If not to the trial court, then it certainly would have been appealed to the New York appellate court, which would hear the appeals. And in fact, I think it's the Supreme Court that is the trial court. So New York has a bit of an interesting system.
Strange terminology. But
indeed. But their appellate court, certainly this would have been what's called an assignment of error attributable to the court if there were a record that even showed this as an objection that was preserved. But where you have a record that is void, meaning there's nothing in it that even mentions this argument or even speaks to this argument, but now it is, you know, belatedly raised only after the Supreme Court issues its ruling. Essentially, what the defense is saying is, hey, we want this to be as effective as against a past trial that was held, which is true because the trial was held, it was over, and they're asking now for the court to essentially turn back the hands of time and apply these rules to that time, even though the defense itself, knowing the case was before the Supreme Court, never bothered to raise it and never bothered to put the court on notice so that there was even one sentence in the record that said as much. And you're right, the opportune time would have been when they called that those witnesses, and actually they had two chances to preserve it and they missed it. They could have done it for either one of the witnesses and did it for neither.
All right. So there is something in appellate practice that means when you argue cases before the courts of appeals that say, okay, I didn't object, I perhaps waived my objection, but there's an error so blatant that it's called plain error, and therefore I can raise it even if I didn't object. The defense is saying this is plain error because the Supreme Court spoke to this and spoke to it loudly and strongly, and you just cannot go forward with this, Judge Mershon. This is plain error, even though we didn't object. What do you think about that and that term as it applies here?
I definitely think that it's worth the argument for the defense to make, but I don't know how strong that argument is, because if in fact it's plain error, then the argument is, how was Judge Marchand to know the outcome from the U.S. Supreme Court?
How was he to know it was plain error?
Right. How was he supposed to know it was plain error? And there, you know, the reasonable testing of that would certainly fall in favor of the judge, who has no ability to know how the U.S. Supreme Court is going to rule. So, although, again, I think for there to be really strong defense of the defendant, I wouldn't be surprised by the argument, but I would be surprised, I think, by any finding that the judge could or should have known that this was plain error, because the plain error is as against the court. It's not even as against the prosecution. It is the court committed plain error, which is what then triggers the cure, whatever it is the court, this higher court deems is the cure.
And how can you have plain error if you don't know what's coming?
Right. You have no way of knowing. He does not have foreseeability powers to that degree. That's just not possible. But I guess it's a good try.
I can see you on the bench right now. Good try.
You know, when I was in elementary school, they
fine argument, very, very, very articulate. Good try.
Good try. You ready for lunch now?
There's another term, though, that the prosecution has brought up that we may hear in the next few weeks, and I want to make sure our listeners understand that term, too. And that's the term harmless error. And the prosecution is saying, look, even if we had these two witnesses testify, and we're saying that it's a sliver of the total evidence against Trump, and we shouldn't have had them testify, we shouldn't have put in the records of his day-to-day practices, we shouldn't have put in the records of the tweets, all of that constitutes harmless error. What does that mean? Now let's translate that for our listeners.
Indeed. And I think, Judge, as you would probably agree, I have never had the experience either as a litigator or as a judge where a trial went on with, it was perfect. There were no issues. There was nothing that could have possibly ever even been perceived to be wrong. There are always those opportunities because trials are handled by humans that errors might happen. And insofar as they may, the errors are ranked kind of in degrees. And so, you know, we talk about plain error, which is, that's what we talked about. That's the blatant, obvious, on its face. You know, clear. How did you not see that?
Gobsmacked between the eyes, right?
Right. All the way down to harmless error, which is the kind of error that takes place in a trial that has no impact on its outcome. That even with this commission, if you disregarded that error, the outcome would likely still be the same. The propensity and likelihood that the outcome would be unchanged is exponentially high. And so that is how harmless the error is, because the error doesn't change the outcome. And that's essentially what the prosecution is saying, is that even if we agreed that these two witnesses, which, by the way, Judge, is kind of shocking, because my recollection is that the defense spent an awful lot of time in their summation talking about the testimony of Michael Cohen. And so if the argument here is that it's these two witnesses whose testimony and evidence related thereto should not have been admitted, that certainly did not seem to be the point of reliance during the trial itself. It seemed more so pointed at star witnesses, Ms. Daniels and Mr. Cohen, and with only passing mention, I believe, to these witnesses that are highlighted in the defense's in their motion, and never once preserved as objections during their testimony. And so this is, I mean, if again, this is that whiplash that I would suspect Judge Marchand is having, like, wait, what? I mean, I don't even know, of all the witnesses, do I even recall these two witnesses testifying given the focus on everything else? And so that's what the prosecution is saying, is, hey, listen, Judge, even if we were wrong in permitting these ladies to testify and bringing in this additional evidence, the other evidence is so overwhelming that this is harmless in the on balance in the grand scheme of things. This does not affect the outcome at all. And if we handed this back to a jury minus that stuff, they'd come back with the same result.
You're right. Let me just emphasize that no trial is perfect, just like no play is perfectly performed. No trial is perfect. So there are always errors of some sort. The losing party, the defense in this case, can take it to a court of appeals, and the court of appeals reviews what the trial judge did and can say, you know, the trial judge made a mistake here, but it was harmless. It didn't do anything. Or the trial judge made a mistake here, and it had a constitutional or some major statutory impact on the outcome of the case. That is error. That's not harmless error. I do have to share a story with you. When I was at the Supreme Court as a judicial fellow and working in the administrative office of the Chief Justice, occasionally a group of us would get to have lunch with one of the justices. And on one day, it was Justice Antonin Scalia, who was an amazing character, even though I disagreed with his judicial philosophy. He was amazing. And his definition of an appellate judge was this, compared to a trial judge. He said the trial judge is on the front line of the battle. The appellate judge sits on horseback on the rise above the battle, and after the battle's over, rides down and shoots the wounded. And I thought, well, that's sort of what appellate courts do.
Rides down and shoots the wounded.
So in this sense, we've talked about plain air and harmless air. They're at opposite ends of the spectrum. And they aren't arguing this to a court of appeals. They're arguing this to a trial judge to apply those standards of plain air and harmless air. One last thing, and this is, I don't know the answer to this, and I'd like to get your perspective of what you would do. Let's say that the Judge Mershon allows the case to go forward and allows the case to go forward to sentencing on September 18th. That between September 6th, when he said he's going to decide it, and September 18th, gives 12 days for, in this my hypothetical, the defense, to take this matter to the Court of Appeals. Does Judge Mershon go ahead and sentence Donald Trump on the 18th? Or does the Court of Appeals stop the sentencing to review the case? Because we know it's going to go to the intermediate level Court of Appeals in New York. It's going to go to the top level appellate court in New York, and then most likely onto the Supreme Court. At what point does Judge Mershon stop what he's doing?
First of all, I think you've adequately described Judge Mershon as saying he's a student of the law. I think he respects the law. He respects his colleagues. He respects this process. He's demanded that others show the same level of respect and deference that the process is worthy of. But I think that he's also a practitioner of judicial independence. And so he'll make a decision. And if in fact his decision is that if there were error performed during the case, which again, no case is ever perfect, but if his decision is that there was harmless error and he proceeds with sentencing, I believe that the only way a sentence is not pronounced and therefore a conviction attaches is if the appellate court issues an order for him to not impose that sentence. I believe that that is how he responds. Otherwise, I believe, listen, and from a human standpoint, I believe Judge Mershon wants this case filed out of his courtroom as fast as possible. But I think that he's also not going to rush to make any decisions that show or even pretend to curry favor with one side or another. Notwithstanding everything he's endured, I think he still is going to follow the law. And the only way he's not going to follow all the way through to if he makes a certain finding, the only way he doesn't do it is if an order is entered by the appellate court that orders him not to, pending review.
Well, it's going to be interesting to watch over the next few weeks to see what exactly is going to happen with this first application of the immunity case. I know Judge Cannon applied it, but I'm not counting that one.
Okay. In a 90-plus page opinion that was written over one weekend.
Yeah, I'm not counting this one. This is the first one of a trial, and certainly the first one that's trying to wipe away guilty verdicts, 34 of them in felony cases in New York. So it's going to be interesting to watch. Really appreciate Judge Gale, as always, our conversation. I hope we didn't get too far in the weeds for people, but I hope we defined things as we went along, because there's some really interesting legal issues here.
Indeed, indeed, Judge. It's always good spending time with you. And the way that you educate me and the public is always so helpful. And so we thank you and we thank our listening audience.
And how did they find us?
Please check out Next Witness, Please. You can find us on any platform where you find your favorite podcasts. That includes Apple, Amazon, NPR, and every place else you log
Spotify,
in.
Spotify, Audible.
Spotify, Audible. We and are more. And more. We're everywhere. And so we would hope that you would not only tune in, but that you subscribe. You rate us, you like us, and we know that you do because you keep coming back, that you'll continue to join us as we look to improve your understanding of this mysterious system we call justice and hopefully continue to earn your trust in this system. Judge Tom, it's always a pleasure to be with you.
Oh, it's always a pleasure to be with you. We try to do this once a week if we can, once every 10 days or so. Sometimes it takes us a little longer with our busy schedules, but we try to get something out to you on a regular basis and make it timely to the news so that you can follow along with better understanding. If you do have a question, though, or a comment about our podcast, you can email that to me, and you can do that at hodson@ohio.edu. That's HODSON at ohio.edu. Also, if you have a question about the law or a show that you would like us to cover something in particular, email that to us and we'll try to accommodate you in the near future. Next Witness, Please is produced by WOUB Public Media. Colin Cameron is our co-producer and audio engineer. And Judge Gale and I will be back really soon to give you more insights into the law. Until then, have a good day, everyone.
And take care, folks.